Tech Talk with Lee Stark.
Good morning, Lee. How are you?
I'm okay, mate. Yourself?
Not too bad, mate. That story about more Australians requiring digital skills, not surprising, is it? And as we go further down the road, we're going to need more and more Australians requiring those skills. I was surprised to see that each year in the last 3 years, the computer literacy has almost doubled every year.
Actually, one of the things I really like about that story is it highlights something that I've been saying for years, which is that a lot of people seem largely afraid to actually play in tech. There's almost this fear that they're going to break something, so they didn't learn ages ago, so they won't now. And one of the things, if there are any listeners of the show, you won't break technology if you're afraid of it. The best way to get stuck into tech is to actually try using it. You're less likely to break something, and you're more likely to learn something.
Well, governments are talking about bans on internet access on sites like Facebook, Instagram, etc. For teenagers. They haven't decided what age they're looking at the moment, but there's been talk of, you know, 13, 14, 16. Mm. Can I ask you, how will they go about doing that? What will be a way that they'll actually be able to lock, if let's say they decide the age is 14, what will they do to make sure that people under the age of 14 don't have any access to those banned sites?
So this is still a growing topic both here and around the world. In America, they're actually trying to work out how they put this sort of ban in place in places like Florida. At the moment, the expectation would be that because they're holding the social media providers responsible, like Facebook and TikTok and whatnot, it would be incumbent upon them to work it out. However, one of the logics, one of the schools of thought that makes sense here is they might force Facebook users, like adults, which are predominantly adults, to actually have some sort of a verification system, which is similar to how it works on some other types of websites. In certain states in America, for instance, pornography websites are required to have a verification system. So it will probably work likely to that, also very similar to that, simply because kids don't have a license or a forced ID that they have to use. All adults do have some form. It's either a driver's license or a passport. So there's a way to instantly link that information together. It's much easier to force adults to have a connection from a certain country than it is to force children. And right now, and I did this test earlier this week just so I could write a story on it, if you are under 13, all you have to do is pretty much just change your birthday if it pops up that you're under 13, and that's all you have to do. To pass the whole age test, you just have to lie about your age. But if you have a verification system like a driver's license, you clearly can't lie about that.
You can't, but if the age was 14, no 14-year-olds in Australia have a driver's license. So what would they use as verification? Just really, they could only use a date of birth, could they not? Although I did read one story where there was talk of facial IDs and things like that.
It seems unlikely to do facial ID simply because even if you could get an AI to actually, like, there's two schools of thought here. You could analyze a person's age solely on their image, which seems unlikely to work, or you could still link a facial ID to a license or some form of connection like that. What I suspect will happen if you're under a certain age and if there's somehow a law that says parents can still choose, because I think that's probably the better approach if you allow parents to decide whether their kids have access to social media. And there are valid uses for kids to have access to social media beyond the fact that it's part of how they grow up these days. I think in that instance, the person who has the account, if it's already tied to mum's or dad's driver's license, then at that point they can give the authorization and they can have a link and decide what goes in and out. But again, this hasn't been decided yet. The government has largely drafted these rules to basically say it becomes onus on the social media provider to work it out. Well, otherwise, they basically get they get fined in the process.
And then I suppose it's also the responsibility of the parents to make sure that the kids don't know their passwords or their age or their license number or those sort of information so that they can access without mum and dad knowing.
This is a lot. This is very similar to the whole downloadable content furor that issues we've had in the past, which is simply that if your kids wanted to download stuff off the App Store or the Google Play Store, the problem would be at times that they would know your password, so they could actually download everything and start charging you money. So your kids should not have access to your important documents, your important details, and your important passwords. And this is kind of like that. They shouldn't, even if they had access to your driver's license, the logic would be they wouldn't be able to use your driver's license to verify their access to a social media website, those two would be tied together. And I suspect that's like that with betting sites as well. I don't use betting sites, so I have no idea. But verification systems typically are assigned to a specific person. It's much like when you walk into a voting place like you might have done yesterday, and you say, I'm this person, here's my driver's license, that's you checked off. That's largely the way it would work. Your kids shouldn't be able to use it. But you as a parent could theoretically say, I give access rights to a child to create their account, and it's connected to mine, and that might work.
Say the age was 16, which for my thought is far too old. I mean, okay, 13, 14, fine. But what about, okay, let's talk 13, 14-year-olds. These days, there would be many, many 13 and 14-year-olds that have had access and been using the internet for years now.
Yep.
Does this mean if this ban comes in that all of a sudden those 13 and 14-year-olds that have been using the internet, have had access to the internet for years, all of a sudden they're going to be banned from using the internet until they reach the age of maybe 16?
Theoretically, yes. I'm not a huge fan of this idea either. I think a lot of it should come down to parents making this decision, not having a government make it for them. I know there are a lot of parents who are concerned about this and want the government to make it easier for them, and I totally understand that. I just don't think it applies to all parents. But yes, that's how that would happen. What I suspect will happen if it's a verification system is that anyone who's registered from Australia or is technically accessing it from here, and that's very easy for companies like Facebook or Meta and TikTok to check, is that if it's verification based, they'll get a note saying they've got like 30 days to verify, otherwise their account will be limited. And if you obviously don't verify and you don't have that ability, their account effectively would be blocked or cut off. That's what I suspect would happen, but as I said, it's still really early days. We don't know what's going to happen.
Apart from places like China, are there any other countries in the world that already have these bans in place for teenagers?
Yeah, so the US is one of the ones that actually started dabbling well ahead of everyone else. It's because of Florida that actually had this proposal that's put in place. No one's actually worked it out yet. As I said, forcing a social media giant to actually work out how you block a specific age group is still relatively new. I've not seen it working in certain places, but we have seen Facebook obviously try blocking certain countries from its news access before, so we know it can segregate people and change its feature set solely on a request by a government or even a request by its own internal staff.
I suppose it's easy for the politicians to say to the social media companies, you have to do this, and if you don't do it, we'll fine you enormous amounts of money. Some of those social media companies would probably laugh at the fine, would they not?
Yeah, maybe, but the fines will eventually rack up. I mean, we don't know what the fine would be beyond the fact that basically angry parents would... I mean, we saw South Australia's proposal this week before Albo announced that they would... his government was going to do something. And the South Australian policy basically says they're opening up to fines from the government and from lawsuits from parents, which is, I'm never going to defend large companies from doing the wrong thing, and Meta does a lot of wrong things. But the reality is that could get scary quickly. Even when Facebook was threatened at one point with, having to pay news organizations lots of money to effectively scrape their news, which is what was actually happening, they basically returned fire with, we're not going to let anyone have access to news. So making money is clearly the point of these companies, and so they will probably respond by actually, coming up with a way to fulfill those responsibilities.
It seems there may be many parents, many, many parents that just wish this social media thing would all go away and they didn't have to deal with it. But that's the emu sticking their head, or the ostrich, not the emu, the ostrich sticking their head in the sand, isn't it? It's not going to go away. If anything, it's just going to get bigger.
You can't put the genie back in the bottle.
Yeah, that's right.
Around for a long time. And it's very similar to what you were saying before about digital skills. A lot of these things can be learned over time. And your kids are actually in an ideal position to actually learn with you. And like you will probably learn things from them. In a few years' time, when my girls are old enough to use social media, I will learn things from them. And I'm the tech guy that many people come to. And I'm okay with that. The reality of these things is they're always changing. It's very similar to scams. And we find with scams and scam logic that the only defense literally is education. You can't get software to throw it all out because it's always evolving. It's education. So learning about this stuff, working out how it works, and dabbling in it, trying it, is your best defense at understanding. It's not just scams, it's social media, it's anything digital. The more you learn, the more power you have, without doubt.
Well, for older Australians who have made the decision they don't want to have anything to do with the internet, I mean, there's going to come a day when that's just not going to be able to work for them, because I'm thinking of electronic banking here. I mean, that's the way banks are going. They don't want to see you in a branch. They don't want to have anything to do with you. They want everything to be done online, and that's just one example.
Yeah, and it's happening in a lot of places. Well, we know, for instance, that older generations, I think we said this last week, were targeted more and more by scammers, for instance. And so older generations, because, again, education is the answer, need to be more aware of this stuff than anyone else. So, yeah, it's an issue. But as I said, you can't really break anything with technology. And if you do break something, you can always email yourself to ask me or any of the other tech people around the country on any station you might be listening to, simply because technology itself is actually quite durable. It's resistant. The best way to learn it is to experiment with it. And the reality is you're probably not going to break anything with today's modern devices. So if you're afraid of it, have a modern device, use your internet banking that way and see what happens. I genuinely say it's not going to hurt you. If anything, it's going to make you more empowered.
We've got a question from Anne. Anne has a Samsung Galaxy S9 with a Samsung account.
Okay.
She cannot change her email on the phone from an old address to her current email address, which is linked to the Samsung account. She has been to her local Telstra store, and they said it is too hard. Is there a way she can change her email in her phone to the new one linked to the Samsung account?
So Samsung accounts only decide things like where your Samsung information is backed up to, wearable information, things like that. It might be linked to a Samsung washing machine if you have one of those. So the way you probably change your email address on that is very, very, very similar if you've still got an old email address on an iTunes or an Apple account or something like that, which is to go to Samsung's website, log in there, and see if it allows you to change your email address specifically aligned to that. The email address there is probably just a login system. But I was going to say, rather, if Samsung doesn't let you change your email address on your Samsung account, and by the way, it's just your Samsung account for like backing up small amounts of data and linking it to a watch, that as an example. And S9 is quite old, so I'd understand why an email address might have changed in that time. If you're worried, just create a new Samsung account. Log out of the old Samsung account on your phone and just create a new one. That Samsung account doesn't do a whole lot in the grand scheme of things. It's mostly there to back up small amounts of information and things like passwords and whatnot. And you can also back up your passwords to other things on an Android phone, like the Google Passwords app. That's largely what it's there for. It doesn't do a lot more than passwords and small amount of personal information. I try logging in on the Samsung website and seeing if you can change your account or profile information. That might work. And if it doesn't, just log out and create a new one. It's probably the fastest way.
All right, Anne, I hope that helps you. Apple, Lee, had a big event this year. I've noticed, though, over the years, Apple's events used to get so much free publicity. It was always headline stories in the breakfast television, you know, hours after the event, all that sort of thing. That seems to not be the case anymore.
It's not as, I mean, I don't want to say it's not as exciting, to be honest, because for tech journalists, and any event, not just an Apple event, is like a tech wonderland for us. There's not something new to talk about, so there's that. But the publicity angle, I mean, everyone writes about it, everyone knows about it. I want to say that the entire world is saturated with something when a news story comes out. I don't technically have to write it, but I will, as will every other tech journal in this country, so it's pretty much a given. But I think one of the other reasons is, because this technology largely becomes normal, not all of it is exciting anymore. I saw a friend the other day who said this might have been one of his least excited about Apple events in a long time, because a lot of the technology was iterative. And he's largely right to a degree, but that's not an Apple problem. That's like that for almost every phone and hardware maker. It's rare to find a piece of new technology you genuinely get super excited about. There have only been a few this year that I've genuinely been super excited about. One of them costs over $5,000. And the other one is on my desk right now, and it's a gadget for kids that's under $200. So there's not a whole lot for new device makers or for new people to get super excited about in terms of like new, hot, amazing things. But there are some things about these new Apple products that are exciting, especially if you're upgrading.
Give me an example.
So So if you happen to be a photographer, one of the things I actually like about the new iPhones, which are coming out at the end of this week, are the fact that there's a little, it's not a button. We thought it was going to be a button, but it's a little kind of slide mechanism. So it's a capacitive button. It's almost like a tiny touchscreen on the side that you run your finger over, and it will allow you to actually control the camera almost like it was a real camera. So it'll let you control the aperture, because we have aperture in phones these days in portrait mode. It'll let you control the focus, and you can even press it and make it activate like a shutter mechanism on a camera to focus, lock, and fire a shot. So this is Apple trying to give more power to people in the camera side of things, regardless of if you buy the inexpensive iPhone or the most expensive one, so the iPhone 16, 16 Plus versus 16 Pro/Pro Max. The other thing I also like is that that sort of technology is coming to the less expensive model. The Pro and Pro Max models have always been really cool, but they usually get this technology well ahead of everything else. This is the first time in a while where the inexpensive model has genuinely been probably exciting, simply because it's kind of the all-round device. It has a good screen, but not a great screen. It could be a lot better on paper. It's got that extra button. It's got the new action button from last year's big iPhone as well. And it's got a macro camera in it as well, so they've improved the camera stack significantly. There's a lot of good reasons to consider both if you're an iPhone person, but the iPhone 16 and 16 Plus seem like the best well-rounded iPhone Apple has made in a long time. Weirdly, that's not the product I'm mostly excited for. The product I'm mostly excited for is already out, and they've announced a feature upgrade to it that is really interesting. The AirPods Pro, which are currently out now, they're getting a feature drop later on, which will actually turn AirPods Pro into a hearing aid and a hearing test. And that is really interesting, because that takes something that a lot of people already have. It takes earphones that have been out for 2 years and turns them into what is effectively a clinical-grade medical device.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's forget Apple for the moment. They've had enough free publicity. Let's talk about DJI. Now, DJI, obviously they make drones. There's now a personal drone that will, take a selfie video of you, if you like.
Yeah, I thought this was a joke when I saw it, because a few years ago, I swear a company actually did an April Fool's Day joke of this exact thing, but this is a real thing. So DJI has created this thing called the DJI Neo, and it's basically a compact drone you can put in your hand, weighs about 135 grams, so it's not significantly heavy at all, has a 4K camera and some AI to track your face, and you can use it inside as well as outdoors. That really surprised me, simply because indoor drones scare the living everything out of me just in terms of what they're going to bump into. It's got AI to deal with that as well. But basically, you'll be able to let this thing hover in the air with your inside and outside, and it will record video while it's hovering there, or circle around you, or zoom and do things like that, so that instead of having to need a friend to help you film yourself, or maybe if you, I don't know if it works for a news camera system, I suspect their cameras are much more complicated than the one inside that one, but basically, instead of needing a cameraman or a friend, you'll be able to record yourself using a drone. And they thought of the whole microphone angle, because clearly a flying camera is going to pick up on wind noise, so you can actually record from your phone's mic, or from a mic plugged into your phone, or over Bluetooth. So it's a really interesting approach to this whole futuristic angle of having selfie video, like recording yourself doing things and not needing anyone else there alongside you.
Well, you mentioned it. I was thinking of further down the track, I can see news reporters that are on site not needing to take a camera person with them or a sound person with them anymore. Mm. They just take the little drone and they do the whole thing themselves and send it back to the newsroom.
Yeah, I mean, when I've done TV crosses, I mean, we're kind of getting roughly to that point in small ways. And a lot of us just typically find a cameraman sent our way, and then we talk to those people over the phone while they're recording us solo. So, and then they stitch it all together to look like we're there alongside them, which is just how, part and parcel of how it works. But yeah, this could be that sort of system for a news cross later down the track. Instead of needing a camera person, they bring out a drone that does that. I don't know how this will handle, you know, being in a field of drones. This is still really new, and outside there are regulations from CASA, the Civil Aviation Authority, that regulate where you can use drones. And I have asked DJI how this one is affected. The fact that this works indoors is a genuine surprise, because drones are typically not made for indoor usage. There's a risk they might bump into pretty much everything and break, fall, that sort of thing. So that was an interesting thing that I learned, that this could actually work with. I'll be curious to play with it and wait for my golden retriever to knock it down the first chance you get. But this will work indoors and outdoors, and so it does create an interesting take on what the future of cameras could look like.
Vodafone's going to get better mobile service in rural Australia next year. How are they going to achieve this?
So they're actually going to use Optus's network. Now, Optus has the second largest network outside of Telstra, and a lot of the Optus coverage does handle rural Australia, but Optus is getting improvements because they're erecting more 5G sites as well. So that number is going to increase hugely over the next few years, especially over the next 5 to 10 years. So more 5G, better coverage. But Vodafone is benefiting from this collaboration in such a positive way. Basically, Vodafone's footprint goes from 400,000 square kilometres, which is effectively cities, to roughly 1 million square kilometres. And that is a huge increase for a telco that did not have that previously. The upside is, if you're a Vodafone customer and Optus customer, you don't actually have to do anything. It's just going to happen. So Vodafone customers will, from next year onwards, start getting access to the Optus network just for the reach of their coverage. So you should have more rural coverage. Telstra still seems to have the most at the moment, but it means Optus and Vodafone should provide stronger competition. And that's better for everybody, because it means that prices will become more aggressive between providers. You won't just have to say, Telstra has the best coverage, that's why I pay the most for it. You'll be able to say, hey, Optus and Vodafone are up there as well. Maybe I don't want to pay as much.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Thank you, mate, as always. We enjoy our chat each and every week. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. Have a good week. We'll talk to you next Sunday.
No worries. Happy to help.
See you, mate. Bye-bye. That's Lee Stark. And if you've got any questions, you can send them to us via email. And if you want to go to Lee's website, it's got all sorts of different things on it. It does. There goes a ding. Technology. What's his website? It is, let me see here, picker.com.au. That's PICKR.com.au. We'll catch up with Lee again next Sunday.